Hey, good morning. It's good to see everybody here, and it's good to be back. I haven't been teaching up here for a few weeks, so it's good to be back teaching in front of all of you, and even as nerve-wracking as it sometimes is. So, you know, this morning we're going to be starting off a new sermon series. Before Christmas, we finished the book of Colossians, and now we're going to be starting at the very, very, very beginning of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1. So if you're new to the Bible or new to Creekside, I'm glad you're here for two reasons. One, super easy to find where we're going to be in the text because it's usually I try to explain it for people that aren't familiar with the Bible, like go here and then flip to the right and then just go to the very first chapter of the Bible. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 1. Second reason why I think it's important and why I'm glad we're all here this morning is that these opening pages of Genesis are super, super critical for us as God's people because the Christian faith isn't just a faith that tells us how to escape this world and go to heaven. In fact, that's not even probably even this, I won't get into that. It's not just about going to heaven. The Christian faith is like explains this world that we live in. It reveals to us who God is. It gives us a lens with which to see the world and to understand what we face every single day. And these opening pages of Genesis really lay the foundation for that knowledge. And so my hope is that, and I even as I say this, I know it's such a lofty goal, but my goal as we teach through this is that even to a small degree, that you get a glimpse of the reality that C.S. Lewis was talking about when he talked about Christianity. If you're familiar with C.S. Lewis, you probably have heard this quote before, but he says this. He says, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. You know, what he's saying is that like this faith that we have, this what God teaches us in his word is something that gives us a lens with which to understand reality in a way that makes the most sense of the world that we're in. You know, as I've been telling people that I was going to go into Genesis, everybody's, especially Genesis 1, everybody's like, oh, like, I wonder what you're going to say about like, right? Like if you're familiar with the Bible, you probably know what I'm talking about because and some of you are probably like, oh, great, now I finally get to know how old the universe is, right? Like, as if I know, like, yeah. For those of you that didn't hear, Paul's just a disrespectful guy. I won't repeat what he said. So. He said I was there, so I should know. So, but I've forgotten. So, and I think one of the dangers when we come to Genesis 1 in particular, because it does talk about the creation of the world, one of the dangers we face is that we focus on the wrong things. And so, if that's you, like everything you've learned about Genesis 1 is just about how old the earth is, there's a place to discuss that in Christianity. There's a place for, like, intellectual honesty, for robust biblical conviction, for humility and graciousness to discuss those things. But I want to elevate your hope above all of that. You know, when Rachel and I, before we got married, we were still in college, we were living in Chicago, and we got student rate tickets to see Les Miserables. Most people call it Les Mis because no one knows how to pronounce it, and I'm not even sure I pronounce it rightly. And if somebody claims to know, I doubt that they really know. But everybody just calls it Les Mis, and it's a play. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? And when we went to this play, we got student rate tickets for, and it was some big theater in Chicago. I don't even remember which theater, but it was the first run of Les Mis in Chicago in the late 80s, and shortly after creation. And and we were, of course, in like the 300 section of this theater, and I knew I was in trouble right away when I walked in, just because I realized, man, that the t-shirt cannons are never going to reach up here. And then I realized that the entire show is singing. I mean, I grew up in Corvallis, like doing things like skiing and whitewater rafting. I had never been in a real theater before, and I knew I was in trouble, but I loved the show. But not for the reasons you might suspect. One reason is because Rachel loved the show, and I was still dating her, and I wanted to marry her, and so I loved the show. Two, the set. Has anybody ever seen like the Broadway thing where the set's on the big giant turntable? Yeah, at least the first run of Les Mis, the set is a giant turntable. And it was the most remarkable thing. As a kid that grew up playing Legos all the time, it was the most remarkable thing because Jean Valjean, the like main character, he could, as they're changing scenes, it's not like the lights go dark and all the people go out there and do their thing. Like, he just starts walking on this turntable. He stays in place as the entire set like changes around him. And so the whole set rotates as he's walking like from one place to another. And by the time it sets all the way, turns around, the set's changed. In fact, even the buildings of downtown Paris or wherever it was, would start to like turn as the turntables and come down and become a barricade. Like, the entire thing would just automatically transform in the show. And this is true. Like, I'm not saying this just for the sake of illustration. I left the show having enjoyed myself because I was enamored with the set. And honestly, I could not tell you a single thing about the story. That's true. And it's a tragedy. Because the story of Les Mis is this deep story of like redemption and of love and of sacrifice and of justice and of mercy. And the fact that I came to it and only focused on the set was a tragedy. And I think the same thing often happens to us in Genesis 1, is we focus so much on the mechanics of like, oh, how are those things happening? The pulleys and the whatever, the turntable, that we miss the story. And the story of the Bible is the story of redemption and love and sacrifice and justice and mercy. And we're introduced to the God of the main character of the story, God himself, in the opening pages of Genesis. It's not primarily about how everything came to be. It's about who's the one that did it all. And what we're going to find out as we go through Genesis 1 this morning is that we're going to find out that the God who created the universe is the God who rules over his creation. And he rules over his creation and brings, I'll just read it. The story is a story where we see that the God who rules over the universe creates and orders his world for the good of all that he has made, providing purpose and blessing and rest. That's how God introduces himself at the opening of the Bible, that he's the God who rules over all things, who creates and orders the world for the good of all that he has made, granting purpose and blessing and rest. You know, this morning it's going to break out into four acts, so to speak. The first is we're going to see in verses 1 and 2 that God is the one who rules over all things. The second section of text is verses 3 through 9, where we're going to see that God forms all things and orders all things. Verses 10 through 31, God fills all things. And lastly, God rests in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. So if you could please stand with me, I'm going to read the entire section. So if you need to sit down during it, feel free to sit down. But I'm going to go ahead and read how God introduces himself to us in the opening pages of the scriptures. Then I'll pray and we'll get into our study together. This is God's word for his church. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day. Then God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning, a second day. Then God said, "Let the waters below the heavens be gathered into place, and let the dry land appear," and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind, with seed in them on the earth," and it was so. And the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind, and God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a third day. Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. And God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a fourth day. Then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures and let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. And God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and morning, the fifth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth after their kind. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of the earth and every tree which has fruit yielding seed. It shall be food for you. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth, which has life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their hosts. And by the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all of his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word, and I thank you for revealing yourself to us in your creation, revealing yourself to us in your word, and revealing yourself to us in your son. And so, Father, I just ask that you would empower me to be able to speak your word to your people this morning. I know it's your will that we gather, that we be taught your word, that we be built up. And so I just ask that you would accomplish that this morning for your glory. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. You can be seated. You know, as we get started here in this first point that God rules, what we find out is there's this like tremendous statement in chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There's this declaration that God at some point in eternity past like decides to act, and he acts in a way that the entire like cosmos bursts onto the scene. The entire universe comes into existence. He creates the heavens and the earth. But what we find out in verse 2 is that this heavens and the earth that he created isn't like the universe that we see today. Today we see a universe that's ordered and organized, and we see a planet that's conditioned for life, and that wasn't the case when God created. In fact, look what it says in verse 2. It says, and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep. That idea of formless and void is that everything was like chaos and emptiness and unable to sustain life. You have this picture of the early like creation of just being this chaotic jumbling of the material world shrouded in darkness in which no life can exist. In the beginning, God creates the heavens and the earth was chaos and darkness. And there was the deeps, the primordial, like unfathomable, unsearchable depths of all things. And yet, even at the very beginning of the creation, there's hope, because it says, but the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface, or was moving or presiding over the surface of the deeps. What we find out is even in the midst of the chaos of kind of this early creative moment here in verse 2, that God himself is still in charge. All things have been brought into existence by him. He sits over all things, and he is the one who controls all things and works all things. And it's in that moment of chaos and darkness that God begins to speak. And as he speaks his word, like, he starts to form and bring order to all of creation. And I want you to pay attention to that as we go through this idea that God forms in verses 3 through 9 of the words that are being used and how it's being described, because he's creating things in there, and he's acting in such a way. But the main thing that's happening is actually him organizing this chaos. In fact, verse 2, it's like God speaks all things into existence. He wills all things into existence in the entire universe with all of everything that's in it, down to the smallest subatomic particle, to like the greatest like galaxies, to the whatever lays beyond. Visible matter and dark matter and visible energy and dark energy, and like, for all you physics people, like, whatever all that means. Like, I'm a pastor, not a physicist, so cut me some slack, right? But it's like he takes all of the raw material, all the unformed, untapped potential of it all, and it's dumped out on the table like a giant jigsaw puzzle. And you've got all the pieces and all their chaos there, and then he's going to speak and begin to shape it and form it for the good of his creation. Look what he says. First thing he does is he speaks, and as the sovereign one, his word is perfectly carried out. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning, one day. So God immediately speaks, and he speaks light into existence, and light immediately pushes back the darkness. And he says, this is good, and he names the light, like the light part of the time, day, and he names the darkness night. He sees that it was good. And this idea of naming in the ancient world, it wasn't just like we do today, where like, oh, I'm going to have a kid, and I need to find a name that kind of rhythmically matches with my last name, and, you know, and, right? Isn't too weird, but like not like boring, like, you know, Steve. And, you with me? That's kind of how we do it. And you look up the baby book things, and then you look at whatever. I had four daughters, and we started with my oldest is Janae, which is a kind of a unique name. But then you're stuck with the unique names your whole way through, right? So then you have to kind of go unique. Sophia, who's at the very end, is like the most normal name, because by kid four, we were kind of out of creativity. But I never planned on having to have to do that four times. But in the ancient world... Why was that funny? So, in the ancient world, like, naming things kind of meant that you had authority over them, that you studied them and understood them and knew something about their nature. And here it's significant that God names light and he names darkness. And then day two, notice he's not creating water, he's not creating space, but he's separating water. Let there be an expanse in the midst of the water, verse 6, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters which are below the expanse from the waters which are above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. So here in verse 2, we have the, before the first day of creation even begins, we have God creating everything, and the sphere of the earth and water already existing that the Spirit of God is presiding over, and then God separates it. What it's talking about there is that God makes our atmosphere, that he creates the cloud cover up above, the upper waters, and the lower waters down below, that he separates the two by what he calls heaven or sky, right? We find out later that the birds fly in that, like, that area. So God creates our atmosphere and the clouds and the sky and the seas. So he separates the sea from the sky. Then the third day, verse 9, then God said, let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind with seed in them. And he goes forward talking about how he fills the earth with like plants and fruit trees and everything that's required to sustain life. It's interesting, on day three, and we're going to see this also on day six, that God engages in two creative acts. Initially, he just did one. He creates light, and he separates light from darkness. Second one, he creates the sky, and he separates the upper waters from the lower waters. Like, God's in this business of organizing and separating and setting boundaries, of creating these realms. He then backs off the seas and causes the dry land to emerge. That's his first creative act. And then he fills the dry land with all sorts of plants and animals. And at the end of the third day, like, God is looking upon his creation and he sees this well-ordered creation now, and the sphere of the earth with seas and plants on it and on the dry land. And then we move into the next three sets of days. But it's important to realize that these days in Genesis 1 aren't just a consecutive numbering of days. They're actually parallel to each other. And what we're going to find out is that God creates realms of creation in the first 3 days, and then he fills them with their appropriate beings. I have a chart to help explain this, and that God, like, their third point is God fills, and then here's the chart. God forms in day one, for example, that there's the realm of day and night. He creates light, and he creates this realm of day and night. In day two, he creates the realm of skies and seas. And day three, he does two things. He creates the land, and then he creates plants. And then as we go to day four, he creates the sun and the moon and the stars, this realm of light and darkness, this ordering of time and days and months and years. We see it written for us here in verse 14, then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. And he made the stars also. So what he does is he creates this realm of light and darkness, and then he fills it with the sun and the moon and the stars. I want you just to put a pin in your mind for a second. Like, notice what he doesn't do. He doesn't name. Earlier, he named light, and he named day, and he named night, and he named the sky, and he named the seas. He named the earth, the dry land. But then he stopped naming. He doesn't name the plants. Just says that he fills the light with plants. And here, the writer of Genesis kind of does this awkward thing, the greater light and the lesser light, to describe what we know as the sun and the moon. But God does not name them. But it's not as if God's disinterested in them, because what we find out now, it started up on the first day, but now it picks up as part of the regular routine that God will say, and God saw that it was good. We're going to come back to that. But just notice that from halfway through day three and all the way through the end, he stops naming. On day five, he creates the birds and the sea creatures, and he gives them this command to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. He fills the sea with the sea creatures and all of its life. And then on day six, he does two things again. Just like he did on day three. He creates animals, and then what we're going to see in just a minute is he uniquely works to the creation of humanity. Now, the reason why this is important for us to see is that as God's revealing himself here in the pages of Scripture, he's saying, I am the God who sovereignly creates all this, who takes all of the chaos of this world and who orders it, and creates it, and frames it, and forms it for the good of my creation. He formed the realm of light and filled it with the sun and moon and stars. He creates the sea and the sky and fills it with fish and birds. He creates dry land and he fills it with animals, and at the high point of his creation, humanity. But he's in the business of taking the chaos and forming it for the good of everything he's made. Now, I just want to make a short point of application here before we move on, is that one of the things I love about Genesis 1 is that it speaks to and challenges every worldview that I know of. I think if you were to throw out a worldview, I think every single worldview will be challenged by Genesis chapter 1. Like in our age today, sometimes it does it by directly like making a statement against what we believe or what people believe. Sometimes it does it by answering the question that the worldview can't answer. So for example, we live in a naturalistic age where we live under the assumption, the kind of the waters that we swim in is that this world just came about by like physical chance, and the only thing that's really real is what we can observe and see, right? That worldview, as scientific as it sounds, has certain questions it can't answer, like what happened before the beginning? What happened before that was all kicked off? Like what existed prior to that? And Genesis 1 declares, well, before that, there is a God who is all-powerful, who creates and he forms and he shapes all things for the good of everything that he's made. The same thing was true in the ancient world. This book was written by Moses. It was written as his people first came out of ancient Egypt. And as he's describing God's creation of all of these things, he's not only referring to like physical creation, because in the ancient world, they lived in a polytheistic culture that believed all of those things were gods themselves. So for example, ancient Mesopotamia believed that the deeps, we see that word in chapter 1, verse 2, that the darkness was over the face of the deeps, this primordial, like unfathomable, untappable, like chaos. The deeps was the god Tiamat, and from that sprang creation. The Egyptians referred to her as Nanut, the goddess of the deeps. And so when writer of Genesis comes out declaring like the Spirit of God was over the surface of the deeps, and that God himself is the God that spoke all things into existence, what he's saying is the deeps and the sun and the moon, all of which were gods in the ancient, like Egyptian pantheon of gods, like all of them are simply created beings. And they are all under the authority of God himself. There is no power in this world that can challenge or stand against the creator of all things. There's one God who rules over all. Now, the reason why that's important for us is whether you're naturalistic or whether you're polytheistic or whether you're materialistic or churchistic, I don't know. Like, so we're going into 2026. Some of you are probably looking into 2026 with some anxiety and thinking like, man, there's lots of chaos in this world, lots of disorder in this world. There's lots of powers in this world, whether they be political powers or the moon god powers or whatever powers of this world you might think stand against you. And it'd be easy to kind of enter into 2026 with the way the world is, with a sense of anxiety and fear and worry. But what God wants his people to know is that there is a God of the universe who creates all things and he forms them for the good of everything that he's made. And he was the one that brings order out of chaos. He's the one that rules over every power. And you need not fear if you trust in him. The God that we worship is the God who created all things. You know, as we go through that, though, if it's true for the, if you see like to the sun and the moon, he said, let them rule over the calendar. Which apparently calendars are in the mind of God, you know, the days. And for those of you who don't know, it's not just an inside joke with me about calendars. I really have issues with calendars. I think they're from the devil, but clearly Genesis 1 says something different. They were to rule, the birds and the sea creatures and everything were supposed to be fruitful and multiply, but everything comes together in the creation of humanity. And if it's true for the sun and the moon that God created their realm perfectly for them and gave them purpose, if it's true for the animals and the fish and the birds of the sky that God created the world for them and to perfectly provide for them and give them purpose, and it's even more so true for us because the pinnacle of this story, the pinnacle of creation, is the creation of humanity. Look with me at verse 26. Says this, it says, then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So let me just pause here for a second. Like, what the first thing we find out, like, this passage is not just telling us about who God is, it's telling us something about who we are. And in our world that is so confused about who we are, like, these are important, this is an important passage for us. In fact, we're going to come back to it next week, this idea of what it means to be created in the image of God. But let me just point out a few things this morning. First thing he says, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. What he's saying there is that, just to kind of distill it down in the simplest way I know how, is that apart from any other part of creation, God says, I want to create humanity in a way that is distinct from all other creation, and they're going to be in my image, they're going to be like me, and they're going to be in my likeness, they're going to represent me. So God created us as men and women to be people who are like him and who represent him. And it elevates our place in all of creation beyond anything else, like radically so. And that idea of being like God, it's not talking about our physical characteristics are like him. It's talking about all of those deeper things about humanity, like our mind and our intellect and our will and our capacity to love, our moral responsibility, our understanding of justice and worship. Like, all of those things are part of, like, God creating us like him. And we represent him. You know, in the ancient world, you would have, like, a coin, and it would have a, I guess we still do it today, on the quarter is, well, who, George Washington, is he on the quarter? Nobody used coins anymore, but, like, it represents, like, or in the ancient world, it'd be Caesar. It represents Caesar. His image represents him. And so what God's saying is, I want to create humanity in a way that they're like me relationally and morally and intellectually, and that they represent me on this earth. You know, I think that's why he stopped naming things. Because his naming was an expression of his dominion. He created all of these things, and he named, and he named, and he named, and he named, and then he stopped naming, and he just started declaring everything really good. And I give me some grace on this. This might be my imagination running, but I don't think so. I can just imagine God as he's creating the universe so perfect and so perfectly wired to care for everything that he's created. And as he creates the sun and the moon, and as he creates all these plants and all these animals, and I think there was something in his, and he knows he's going to invite humanity into his dominion. And we'll find out in Genesis chapter 2 that he gives man the task of naming. I think it's like, he's like, man, I can't wait. I just created the sun and the moon, and those things are awesome. And I just can't wait to see, like, this pinnacle of my creation, the first man and the woman, like, investigate those things and understand those things and ponder those things and name them. It's like one of my favorite age, I think, of all the ages of my kids. Like, I love my kids, even the adult ones now. 18 months to 3 years. I think that is the greatest age of humanity. Some of you act like that still, but Shannon. The reason why I love that age so much is because every single day, like, a two-year-old kid is learning something new, and everything is new and exciting to them, right? It's like, whoa, there's a bird, right? And everything is fresh and it's new. And I can just imagine God as he invites the first man and woman into creation to understand and ponder and think about these things that he's created for them. Just the joy that he had in seeing them, like, name them. He's a God who orders and forms and creates all things for the good of his creation, giving them purpose and rest. Hold on. So we find out that we're created to be like him and represent him. We're created to have dominion over the earth, to rule over it like as he would. He invites us into his sovereignty. And then the last thing it says, and we'll pick up on this more next week, but it says both male and female were created in the image of God. Now, some people misunderstand that. and say that that means that God must be both male and female. But that's not what the text is talking about. Like, super, text is super clear. We're created in God's image. He's not created in ours. So when we say God must be male and female because we're male and female, we're reversing that. We're saying God is created in our image. And the Bible's super clear. Is when we start creating gods in our own image and according to our own likeness and according to our own thoughts, like, things go poorly really quickly. What he's saying is that both male and female, like, are there by his design, that he has purpose, and he enters in relationship with both men and women, and they have equality and dignity, and both of them enter into this task of ruling over his creation together. And it's this radical statement of equality between men and women, in fact, between all of humanity, and we'll look at that more next week. So we're created in God's image. We're created to have dominion over the earth, and we're created like equally as male and female image bearers. You know, a couple thoughts before I move on about just application. First of all, if we're actually created to have dominion over the earth, like what, and we do it as being like God and as representatives of God, like, this text should direct how we go about our tasks every single day. Because God is a God who what? Who rules over his creation and who forms it and orders it for the good of all that he has made, giving purpose and peace and rest. In fact, we see that God blessed male and female, and he cares for them. What that means for us is that when we go about, like, our work, whatever that is, you will not be any more human. Like, the most human thing you can do to be in line with who God created you to be is to do your work in a way that orders this world and forms this world for the good of everybody that you can come into contact with, granting to them blessing and giving to them and fruitfulness and peace and rest. And whatever your job is that you give yourself to, like all of us can have, like, some way to connect that, to connect our life to that. This world is a world of chaos and mess, and whether you're at home caring for your home and caring for your children, to create your home as a place of order where your children can flourish and you can give to them, whatever your job might be, if you're in school, like, engaging in your relationships at school, whatever's under your power, the most human thing you can do is to be a person who reflects the grace of God as he gives. And look what kind of God he is. This is amazing. Because after he creates the first man and woman in verse 29, it says this: "Then God said, 'Behold.'" It's like he takes the first man and woman and he goes up on a hill and he's looking over all of his creation. And he's saying, "Look at this. Look what I've made for you." And then he goes on, "And I have given you everything that's food, everything that you need, I've given you. I've blessed you." We saw that in 26. "I give to you." And our God is a God who blesses and who gives and who does so radically and generously to all that he's made. You know, we live in one of the most beautiful parts of the United States, I'm convinced of that, and when we can get outside, when it's not raining on us. And I was thinking about this. We were out at the beach yesterday and looking out over the ocean, and one of the things this text is telling us is that when we look at the intricacies of creation and how God's wired like this world to sustain our life and to care for us, one of the things that should tell us is about the goodness and grace of God. He's a God who gives. You know, so if you're here this morning and you have a view of God that's a God who demands and not a God who gives, that's not the way he presents himself when he introduces himself on the first page of the Bible. And I would suspect that your religion and your view of God comes more from, like, the pagan religions like the Egyptians had than it does from the pages of the Bible. Because the ancient Egyptian religion said that the earth was created and mankind was created there to work the earth so that they could serve the gods, so that the gods could chill out wherever the gods chilled out. Man was there to care for the gods. But here we find out that our God is a God who creates and forms and shapes all things for the good of his creation. He's a God who gives. In fact, the Apostle Paul says that in Acts chapter 17, verses 24 through 25. He's preaching a sermon to a bunch of people in Athens, and he says this. He says, "The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is the Lord of heavens and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things." And if you think God's a God up there who, like, for whatever reason is demanding all this, like, stuff from you, and if you don't do it, you're just going to get smacked, it's not the God of the Bible. The pages of the Bible will, like, overwhelmingly convince you of otherwise if you look at it honestly. God is a God who gives and whose grace existed from the very nature of his character. And so if you're ever in this mode of thinking like, oh, I got to do this, 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 or I got to do this, and or God will do this to me, you're thinking wrongly about who God is. God's like, no, I'm a God who gives and who's gracious and who does all things for the good of my creation. And if you doubt that, look at what I did through my son on the cross when I gave everything for you. Our God is a God who gives. And if you're here this morning going into 2026 and just weary from all of the earning and pleasing and performing and busyness that you have to do to try to bring significance to your life, like, maybe we need to stop that. We're going to get to that when we can start talking about rest in just a minute. But know this, that as God is first introduced, he's introduced as the God who gives. And as his people, we should be the people who seek to do everything we can to be a blessing to those around us, just like he was. Verse 31 kind of wraps up the 6 days. He says this, "And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good." It's the first time it's said that way. God's looking at the creation. He's looking at putting humanity in it. He's looking at everything that he's done. He's like, man, this is awesome. Then there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Don't be fooled by the chapter break there, because chapter 2, verses 1 through 3 is a continuation of the story. "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and all their host. And by the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all of his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all of his work which God had created and made." You know, the story starts with this world as chaos and darkness, and it ends in this well-ordered, beautiful thing, like specially tailored for the good of his creation. And then it says God sees that it's very good, and God rests on the seventh day. He looks out over it, and it says it twice. He completed his work which he had done. He saw this world, that it was a world at peace. It was a world that was whole. It was a world that was well-ordered. It was a world that was designed to care for everything that he had made. It was very, very good. And he was able just to sit back and rejoice over the work of his, I'll say hands, but his work that he spoke into existence. You know, and it says a couple things for us, this idea of like, feeling like we need to keep performing for God. Like God's wired into the very nature of creation. This is before like humanity screwed it all up. He's wired in the very nature of creation, this rhythm of work and productivity and fruitfulness and rest. And some of you need to hear that. Some of you are those people that just always have to keep going and going and going and going and going and going and going. And as soon as like you have like some spare time, it's like on to the next task. And you guys know what I'm talking about? Some of you need to hear that God's designed you to rest. That you can, it's good and part of who he created you to be, to stop and to look at like the life around you and to look at what God's done for you and look at this world that he's created for you and rest. Rejoice in that all. Some of you probably need to hear that you need to work. There's 6 days of that. Paul. Some of you need to hear that you need to work, but I think as Americans who like worship productivity and who just worship our busyness, we feel like we're the busiest generation on the face of the earth, and we may be, but it's not because we lack time. Those of us that live in the industrialized West have more like discretionary time at our disposal than any other generation in the history of the world before us. I've always assumed that. I actually checked the research this week, and it's by like 50% more. And yet, we're just running frantically after all of this stuff. And it's because we lack the discernment to understand what really is going to matter in this life. And we lack the understanding of who we really are. God has wired us to be able to have a time of rest. I can't unpack all of the application of that. I feel my calendar joke earlier in the sermon was because I actually have mental illness around like a season of my life where I burned myself out like pretty dramatically, and now like calendars legitimately cause me anxiety and panic attacks and things like that, even though apparently God's in them. So I have a hard time preaching on rest. But maybe I can tell you from like a person that didn't get it, God has wired us to have like seasons of productivity and seasons of rest. And there's books you can read to that end, but I'd encourage you to consider that. But there's something more important here on the seventh day that undergirds and fuels and sustains it all, is that if you notice, the seventh day never ends in our text. In our text, each day ends with the statement, it was evening and it was morning the second day, or is evening and morning the third day, or is evening and morning the fourth day. When we get to the seventh day, it just leaves it hanging. There's no evening and morning statement. The seventh day never ends. A couple of things I think about that I think are significant. Is like one of them is that even Adam and Eve's work, comparatively to us, was rest. When they entered into the seventh day with the Lord, everything that they did was rest. And because you think about it, like everything we do, like so much of what we do is just trying to hold our ground, right? Like, oh, I got to go exercise because look, right? Like, or I've got to go work like in the yard because the weeds are coming up, or I have to go fix my roof and I didn't fix my roof, so now I have to fix my drywall. And then right? And it's just like one thing after another, after another, after another, and we're just like working so hard just to hold, like keep back the decay that we've invited into this world. The world wasn't created that way. The world that the first man and the first woman lived in was a world where everything that they did like moved things forward. Imagine that. It's like the best hobby ever. You know, those of you who like to work with wood, you know, you can build something and then you can sit back and rest and rejoice in what you've made. But everything was that way until Adam and Eve like screwed it all up when they rebelled against the Lord. Everything was just advancing and creating and having dominion and moving things forward. I can't even imagine a world like that, but one day it'll be restored to us. But more significantly than that is this idea that God's rest, this is God's rest, never ends. And even though the first man and first woman rejected that rest and were turned out into a world of toil, that there is always an invitation back into it. The psalm that we read at the beginning of the service this morning, Psalm 95, talks about God's creation. And then I think in verse 6, this is what we ended with. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker. That's where we ended at the beginning of the service this morning. For he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. There's this statement that God created all things, and he cares for us like his people and like his sheep. Like this whole world is created for our good. And then he says, today if you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts as they did at Meribah on the day at Massa in the wilderness. And then he goes on to explain the hardness of heart of the people of Israel and how they wouldn't believe God and they wouldn't trust God. And then it ends with, in verse 15, verse 11, therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. There's this challenge where God's people were invited into his rest, but then they didn't experience it. The writer of Hebrews picks up this theme for us in Hebrews chapter 4. He says this, and it's a long argument. It begins clear back in chapter 3. But listen to what it says in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 1-4. Therefore, let us fear that while a promise remains of entering his rest, any one of you may seem to have come short of it. For indeed, we have had the good news preached to us. The good news of what? The good news that Jesus is the one who did all the work so we can rest in his completed work. But it didn't profit, just as they also, but the word they heard did not profit them because it was not united by faith in those who heard. He goes on. For we who have believed enter that rest. Just as he said, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. That's that last line of Psalm 95. Although his works were finished from the foundation of the world, for he has said somewhere concerning the seventh day, and God rested on the seventh day from all of his works. I think there's two things I want to point out about that last line there. First of all, writer of Hebrews must have been a bad like annual Bible reading guy like me, because this is that last line, God rested on the seventh day, is a quote from Genesis 2, verse, what, 3? And he doesn't even know where it's from. Yeah, I started reading, I got through Genesis 1, but somewhere there's the, right? Okay, that's a little funny, right? That's not why he does that, but I just thought it was funny. All right, but he quotes Genesis 2, this passage that we're in, and he says, like, oh, God's rest that he invites us into is what he's talking about there. And you enter into rest through faith in Jesus Christ, who did all the work for you. He goes on, verse 9. So there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. The Sabbath is that seventh day rest. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works, as God did from his. Therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest so that no one will fall through following the same example of disobedience. Their example of disobedience was that they didn't believe, so they didn't enter his rest. And he's like, man, when you really understand what Jesus has done for you, when you really understand that he was the king that reigns over the creation, when you really understand that he still invites us into his rest, where all of the striving to please, all of the anxiety over failure, all of that stuff can be like laid to rest because Jesus has accomplished everything for us, we can enter into that rest today. He goes on to talk about our his word, how his word exposes us, and how, and I'll just keep reading. Got it on the screen. For the word of God is living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, and piercing as far as the division of soul and spirit, of both joints and marrow, and able to judge the thoughts and intentions of the heart. God's word will cut you open. And he says this, and there is no creature hidden from his sight, but all things are open and laid bare to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Whatever those heart-level things are driving all of that like inability of us to rest, God knows those things. God can expose those things to you. And then he ends with this great promise. Therefore, since we have such a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, like Jesus did everything for us, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. Like, keep believing what Jesus has accomplished for us. For we don't have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. God's not asking you to perform more, to strive more, to do more. He's just asking you to return, to come to him with confidence in the finished work of Jesus, to the throne of grace, that he can once again like give and bless and restore purpose in your time of need. So Brian, why don't you come up to close us? And it's hard for me to unpack all of this. Like, there's so much, like all of us like strive in so many different ways, but in Jesus Christ, there's this promise of rest. So I'd encourage you, if the Spirit is convicting you of anything, if the sword of the Spirit is cutting it all, like to look into those things that look into your own heart, and what are those things that you're striving for or trusting in or believing other than Jesus Christ? And then more importantly, look to Jesus Christ and everything that he's accomplished for you so that you can find rest for your souls. Brian, why don't you close us? Don't close us in prayer.